Happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. And to begin our program, we're going to be talking with you about strokes. Every 45 seconds, someone in America has a stroke. It's really a loss of brain function. It's a clot. Sometimes bleeding in the brain causes it. And it can spread very rapidly. And so emergency action, fast emergency action, can really limit the damage and dramatically increase a person's chances for survival. We'll be talking about this today. Dr. Matt Jensen with us by phone. Dr. Jensen is a neurologist and an assistant professor in the School of Medicine and Public Health at the UW-Madison Clinical Sciences Center. And certainly if you have a question or comment, I hope you'll join us. The number is 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Dr. Jensen, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it. 750,000 strokes a year in this country?
Yeah, and that number goes up a little bit every year. It's now a little closer to 800.
Why does it go up every year?
The stroke affects people of all ages, but it does predominantly affect people of older ages. And as the population continues to expand in general, but expands predominantly extra in the older age ranges, we're going to see more stroke every year.
Mm-hmm. And the signs, let's talk about those right off the bat.
Yeah, and that's something particularly interested in discussing. There have been studies trying to examine how well the public understands the symptoms of stroke, and unfortunately, it's very low amounts. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that we haven't done as good of a job educating the public as we would like. And the second is just that stroke can look like a lot of different things. The brain does so many different things that problems with the brain can look like a lot of different things. So the warning signs, the symptoms of stroke, are sudden numbness or weakness of the face, arm, or leg, especially on one side of the body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding someone speaking to the person, sudden trouble seeing in one or both eyes, sudden trouble walking, dizziness, loss of balance or coordination, or a sudden severe headache with no clear cause. And those are the symptoms that we really encourage people to call 911 immediately if they notice.
Because there is a sort of a window, if I'm not mistaken, like 3-hour window or something?
There is, and there's kind of a couple of windows. There's a 3-hour window, and there's also kind of a 4.5-hour window. Those time points are somewhat arbitrary. They're based on some of the pivotal studies of the treatments that we know to be effective. In general, we know that the brain cells don't tolerate a lack of blood flow for much time at all. Really, every minute that goes by, a large number of brain cells are lost. And so the sooner we can get to somebody and try to enact a treatment, the more likely they are to have a good outcome.
You know, I want to go to Mary in Darsville, Iowa. Mary, thank you for calling, and tell us what's on your mind.
Good morning, and thank you for having me. I have a 94-year-old cousin. She was on Coumadin back when, and maybe she's on something else similar now. She also is on Digitalis. Just the last couple of days, she had swelling in her left leg. It is firm, some pain. No hot or cold, some throbbing a little bit. Should we be concerned about this and get her in for?
Yeah, I would recommend that she sees her primary care physician. There are a number of things that can cause swelling in the leg. It's generally not related to the nervous system. It can sometimes be from a blood clot in the veins of the legs, but there are some other conditions that can also cause swelling in the legs her physician could evaluate for.
Yeah, not typically a stroke sign?
That's not typically. You know, the swelling is not something we see with problems of the nervous system. We can't. If you see weakness of a limb where you're having difficulty moving or numbness where there's a loss of sensation, that can definitely be a stroke sign.
So, Mary, the advice is to get your cousin in to see her physician quickly, soon as possible. Thank you for calling. Butch in Broadhead, we'll go to you next. Butch, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Great, thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I've got a question that the doctor might be able to give us some information on, and I'm jumping way ahead perhaps of the stroke thing, but our situation is such that perhaps 8-9 years ago my wife had developed symptoms that were stroke-like, also could have been MS and what have you. And so they came to the conclusion in part that she has factor V ad litem. I believe this is what it's called.
Mm-hmm. Yep, factor V Leiden. Yep.
Well, then they and they've been treating her with blood thinners and, not so much thinners, but anticoagulants and some other things. Mm-hmm. Well, where the mystery comes into me is our daughter was tested. She is positive for it.
Mm-hmm.
And during a pregnancy, she had to take expensive blood thinning medicine and be on and off it, you know, during and then right after the pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
She is homozygous,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which means that I have it also. Is this so?
The majority of strokes are caused by blood clots, and blood clots can form in either the arteries where the blood's traveling into an organ or veins where blood is traveling out of an organ. Factor V Leiden is a genetic mutation, and it's very common in people of European descent, particularly. And there's actually many, many people who have the mutation who never have any trouble with blood clots. A small percentage of people with one copy do develop recurrent blood clots, usually in the veins. And then a larger proportion of people with both copies, the homozygous, do have recurrent blood clots, and that, again, is usually in the veins.
Well, and the daughter, who is roughly 25, 26, mm-hmm. She developed a blood clot in her leg. It was nothing serious, mm-hmm. and this was after her child was born.
Mm-hmm.
But recently, a niece of ours, and this is on my side of the family,
mm-hmm.
Had a baby early part of May. She had not been tested for this factor V or anything.
Mm-hmm.
She developed two clots in her lung, and now she's currently on a heart-lung machine and doing well.
Mm-hmm.
But they found clots throughout her body, and then my wife told me today that they had tested her, and sure enough, she's got this factor V.
Yeah.
So we're wondering, is this a more prevalent thing than people are aware of, and is there more danger than what we're even aware of?
It's very prevalent, and I don't have the numbers on the top of my head, but most people that are affected just have the one copy, and their risk of forming blood clots is actually quite low, and there's some debate about the proper blood thinner when there's just one copy of this factor V Leiden. When there's two copies, we know that the risk goes up of forming blood clots, and again, usually in the veins of the legs, which can go to the lungs. And my general advice is that's the kind of situation where it would be a good idea to consult with a real expert in disorders of the blood and clotting, and those are the hematologists, because there can be some real tough decisions about what kind of blood thinners and to what intensity of blood thinning,
because
the blood thinners unfortunately all carry a risk of causing bleeding as well.
Yeah.
So it's never a simple decision, which of these treatments to use.
Perhaps my son and other relatives, should we be tested for this stuff? Or
and again, that might be advisable, and I think the best person to answer that question would be one of these specialists in disorders of clotting, one of the hematologists.
Yeah, so seek one out, Butch, and thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Bill in Sun Prairie, we're on to you now. Hi, Bill.
Hi, great program.
Thank you.
I'm working on a dissertation on atherosclerosis.
Mm-hmm.
And have discovered a few things. One is that there is a strong connection with strokes.
Yes.
Also, a great deal of strokes and heart attacks appear in patients that do not have traditional risk factors.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to hear the doctor's comments on any theories or ideas he may have on this, why atherosclerosis and strokes and heart attacks occur in people without the traditional factors. I'm looking at things like this response to injury hypothesis,
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
plaque is deposited because free radicals are munching away on our endothelium.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you take all patients who've had a stroke, the majority of strokes are caused by atherosclerosis, and the majority of heart attacks as well. Atherosclerosis is the most common disease of blood vessels. It's specific to arteries. We see complications of it typically in later ages where people begin to form blood clots in the arteries that cause heart attack or stroke. But we know that it actually begins very early in life. When they do autopsies on soldiers during war, we see that this atherosclerosis starts during the teenage years in many people, and it builds our whole lives. And then what you refer to, the traditional risk factors, things like high blood pressure, bad lipid profile or bad cholesterol, diabetes, cigarette smoking, poor diet, and a sedentary lifestyle, those things all seem to speed up that process of atherosclerosis, cholesterol forming in the wall of the arteries, and increase the risk of blood clots forming on those plaques. And you're right, we do see people who do not have any of those traditional vascular risk factors. They don't smoke, they don't have high blood pressure, they exercise, and then when we scan the vessels, they may or may not have atherosclerosis, and there are a number of other conditions that can cause blood clots in the vessels. So there clearly are a number of other conditions that can lead to stroke, and there likely are a number of other factors involved in the process of atherosclerosis that we just haven't discovered or fully elucidated. Mm-hmm. What you're discussing about this idea of injury to the interior lining of the arteries is a definite possibility, and there has been discussion about whether it's some kind of infection that's the initial injury to the endothelium or the lining of the blood vessels, or things like you discussed, free radicals. And people are doing research. It sounds like you're doing research on these potential causes.
Yeah. Thanks for calling, Bill. Appreciate it. Chris in Poinette, on to you. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. Good morning. I actually was calling just to reiterate the doctor's emphasis on educating and being self-educated in regards to the warning signs or of potential strokes. I am a 39-year-old male who had my first stroke when I was 26 and my second when I was 30. I was in perfect health. I'm 6'4", muscular, have been an athlete all my life, and kind of literally following a workout at the gym, started developing a headache, unlike those I'd had in the past, and was taken into the hospital that next morning and clinically dead when they brought me in, and was in the intensive care unit for 2 weeks, actually, after the stroke. And unfortunately, because of the timing and because of my good condition, they did not diagnose it as a stroke until almost the third day of being in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And by that point, they had said themselves even that, had they caught it early on, or had they gone about it with the potential of it being a stroke early on, that they probably would have been able to reduce any of the long-term effects. Thankfully enough, that the doctor, while I was in the intensive care unit, even had said, the likelihood of you walking or seeing again are very slim, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm very, very active. I run a scout troop, and I'm still very active with my three boys, et cetera. So the only residual side effect that I got from the first most severe of the two strokes was a blind spot in both eyes, very minimal at best.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. You've had a wonderful recovery.
Well,
did they find the cause of your stroke?
Well, actually, the ultimate cause, after all was said and done, was a patent foraminal valve. They found that the valve had not closed up. I actually went in a year after the second stroke and had heart surgery to patch that hole, and have been 100%, 110% since. But I have actually gone to several different hospitals to visit family members of friends or friends who have had strokes, and were really pretty distraught at the potential long-term side effects or even short-term side effects, and went in and talked to them about the importance of kind of being able to mentally pull yourself through something like that, and understand that there are things you can do that are great for rehab and great to kind of get yourself back on track. It took me almost 9 months to leave the house after the stroke, but all of the doctors admitted that they didn't expect that I would really even be 70 to 80%, and I was 110 by the time I was done, as far as kind of pushing through it and just doing what I could to kind of relearn, in some cases, the different pathways that had kind of been affected from the strokes.
Yeah, that's wonderful. We see a big spectrum of recovery. Some people have wonderful stories, such as yourself, where they really made great gains when they were very severely affected. And unfortunately, some people make slower gains and more incomplete gains. The field of stroke recovery is really exploding right now. There's all kinds of new research and techniques that the rehabilitative therapists are working on, and research into drugs and devices and all sorts of things to try to encourage that process of the nervous system healing itself. And, you know, we're hopeful that over time, you know, in addition to trying to limit the damage initially by people recognizing symptoms and getting in for treatment quickly, we're hoping that we can really encourage better recoveries over time.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling, Chris. I appreciate it, your call and your comments, and good for you. It's a wonderfully great success story. Our guest today, Dr. Matt Jensen, as we talk with him about stroke and stroke treatment. Larry Mueller, Jim Packard, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Matt Jensen, neurologist and assistant professor in the School of Medicine and Public Health at the UW-Madison Clinical Sciences Center, our guest as we talk with him about stroke. Certainly, you can join us with your questions at 800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. We have an email from Kathy in Watertown, Dr. Jensen, and wondering if you could mention the unique telestroke program recently started at UW Health Partners Watertown Regional Medical Center, which uses a two-way video screen. So a neurologist apparently at UW can consult with an ER physician in diagnosing and treating.
Yes. We, stroke specialists, there are not a lot of stroke specialists, and most of us are kind of concentrated in some of the larger academic medical centers. But most stroke patients, when they have their strokes, are going to go to their local hospital, which may be in a smaller community. And the physicians working in the emergency rooms there are excellent, but they don't see as much acute stroke as we've seen. And so oftentimes we're interacting with physicians all over the state by phone when they're having an acute patient in there. They just want some discuss the case. What's even better than that is if we can actually talk to the patient and their family members and look at the patient and examine them through the video and look at their scans. And so we're developing a telemedicine system. And so with Watertown as our first partner, in their emergency room, they have basically it's an IV pole that has a monitor on it and a camera. And so we can do two-way video and voice. And the picture and audio is very good, so we can talk to the patient, talk to their family members, get the story, do our own examination to see how severely they're affected, and then we can look at their CAT scan of their brain. And in that way, we feel we're able to provide better quality advice, actually laying our own eyes on the patients and you know, interacting with them directly.
And, you know, as that's a great program. And as we're talking about looking at the patient, I'm wondering, I know there are some things that say you're not the victim, but you suspect someone is having a stroke.
Mm-hmm.
I know there are some things that just a layperson can do with his or her friend or relative or whatever.
Yes. Yeah, there's a very quick and simple, basically neurological examination that if you're a bystander, if you're a friend or family and you see somebody and something is suddenly not right with them and you're wondering about a stroke, there's a public education campaign, and it goes by the title of FAST, F-A-S-T. And the F is for face, and you can ask the person to smile and look to see if one side of the face is drooping or lower than the other. And you can ask them to raise both arms, that's the A, and see if one arm kind of drifts downward or if they're unable to lift one of their arms. The S is for speech. Ask the person to repeat a very simple sentence and listen to see if the words are slurred, if they sound like they're drunk, or if they're speaking gibberish or can't even understand what you're asking. And then the T is for time. If you see those things, any of those are abnormal, that very well could be a stroke, and we'd advise calling 911.
There's something to do with the tongue as well, isn't it? Isn't there?
You can ask the person to stick out their tongue, and very rarely with a stroke, the tongue will go over to one side. That can be a little misleading, so
okay.
The sticking with the face, the arms, and the speech is the most high-yield kind of thing.
Okay. Makes sense. Jane in Waukesha, it's your turn now. Hi, Jane.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First off, I just wanted to say thank you for having the opportunity for a program like this on public radio. I think it's extremely important. I'm a physical therapist, and a lot of the patients that I see are either have stroke as a primary diagnosis or as a secondary, you know, comorbidity that maybe they've suffered a stroke in the past. One of the things that I would just like the doctor to touch on is it always saddens me when I see patients that have had a stroke, and when I talk to them about their stroke, they'll tell me that, you know, oh, you know, a couple of weeks before I had the stroke, this funny thing happened to me in church, and I couldn't pick up my arm and for a few seconds, and, you know, then it went away, or, you know, different signs that were warning signs of perhaps a transient ischemic attack or a TIA. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the public just doesn't understand that that's like a freebie, that you know, they should seek their medical attention then and hopefully could prevent a stroke.
Yeah. Well, thank you for all your good work with physical therapy. We work with a lot of physical therapists here as well in the recovery. I'm sorry I cut you off. You were about to say something.
That's okay. The other thing that I failed to mention to your screener, but then when I was listening to the program further on, was that... And you had touched on it. There's a lot of exciting research. I'm especially interested in an area called constraint-induced movement therapy that I'm guessing that you're probably familiar with it. And it's just it is a very exciting thing in that people that have had a chronic stroke, you know, up to whatever 20 years ago, that there are sometimes individuals that can certainly benefit and gain some functional recovery from treatment. So I just always tell patients, you know, don't give up hope.
Yeah, I'll touch on both those briefly. Yeah, you brought up the transient ischemic attack, and we call those TIAs, or we sometimes say the term mini stroke. And those are basically the exact same symptoms as a stroke. They just go away very quickly, so they'll go away within a few minutes or maybe an hour or two. And a lot of people do really kind of blow that off because unlike with a heart attack, there's no pain involved with stroke. You know, it may just be some clumsiness or weakness of one arm or one leg or numbness or trouble speaking. But that really, as you mentioned, is really an amazing opportunity, a golden opportunity. I always kind of refer to it as a warning shot. You know, those are the people that are actually at the highest risk of having a major stroke in the short term. And those are the people we really want to see very quickly because we have this opportunity to intervene and try to prevent an actual stroke and damage to the nervous system. And then you mentioned some of the rehabilitative techniques and therapies that are coming out. You specifically mentioned this constraint-induced movement therapy, and you know much more about this than I do, but the general idea is if you have a weak or clumsy hand or arm, you will naturally stop using it, and you'll favor the side that's working fine. And there's some evidence that at certain points during the recovery, it may be helpful to actually kind of restrain the good hand and force a person to really use the hand that's not doing as well.
Oh, yeah.
We're still working out the proper timing of that, whether it should be done immediately or really delayed for a period of time. But there is some evidence coming out now that, in addition to all the other rehabilitative therapies, can be very helpful.
Yeah. Thanks again, Jane, for calling. Appreciate it. And thanks for your work. Appreciate it very much. Patty in Winona, Minnesota, will turn to you. Hi, Patty.
Hi. I have a question about family history and stroke.
Mm-hmm.
My maternal grandmother died after a stroke, and my father had two major strokes before he died eventually of cancer. Mm-hmm. Currently, I'm 51, and I'm considering going on HRT therapy for menopause.
Mm-hmm.
Is this something I should be concerned about?
They're both great questions. They're kind of two questions, and the first one, as far as family history, it depends what age people in your family have vascular disease, either heart attack or stroke. Because vascular disease, heart disease is the number one killer in America, and stroke is number three. Cancer is number two. And they happen at later ages predominantly. As we've heard earlier, they can happen at younger ages, but they do happen at older ages. If everybody in your family has vascular disease at older ages, in the 70s, 80s, or 90s, that doesn't really affect your individual risk. if people in your family are having early age vascular disease, like heart attacks and strokes in their 30s or 40s, then you may have some risks that run in the family that could be genetic. And I just recommend talking that over with your primary care provider. They may want to do some more tests than they would otherwise.
Yeah.
And then the question of hormone replacement therapy is complicated. We used to think hormone replacement therapy actually lowered the risk for stroke and heart attack. And then there was a very large study that was completed a few years ago called the Women's Health Study, and it turned out it was actually the opposite. The long-term hormone replacement can increase the risk of stroke and heart attack. It's not a huge difference, but it is there statistically, and we're not quite as sure about short-term hormone replacement. But in general, you know, we do have to advise that if a person is considering hormone replacement therapy, that does appear to increase your risk slightly of heart attack and stroke.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Patty. John in Milwaukee emailed us as well, Dr. Jensen, and asks if you would how you determine after the stroke occurs whether it was a blockage or a leak. I assume the treatments are quite different, and it's important to know which had occurred.
The treatments are quite different, and the majority of strokes are caused by blockage of an artery, almost always from a blood clot, and a smaller percentage are from bleeding into the brain or around the brain. There are some things we can see just by symptoms and signs that can suggest one versus the other. With bleeding into the head, the pressure goes up inside the skull, and so a person often has a very severe headache or they may start vomiting. And the blood pressure also tends to rise quite a bit. However, since imaging of the brain has become very widely available, particularly using the CT scanner, we know that that isn't always the perfect test. So in general, we really need a CAT scan of the brain when somebody comes in with a stroke-like presentation to be sure.
Let's go to Sander in Chippewa Falls. Hello, thank you for calling.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mueller and Dr. Jensen. My question is, when people have symptoms of strokes, but there's no hard evidence that it's occurred, in my case a year ago, all the symptoms, doctors thought it was happening, but there was no blockage found and no bleeding found. Since then, I've had difficulty with seeing, and this looks like it's leading towards macular degeneration. Mm. Any connection between them in any of the research that you've found?
I am not aware of a connection between stroke and macular degeneration, other than both can seem to preferentially affect older individuals, but can be seen in younger individuals as well. You mentioned the, you know, when the symptoms fit for stroke, but the tests don't end up showing actual injury to the brain or blockage of the arteries. We do see that sometimes, and that's still that. There's a couple of things that can be. One is that there was blockage of an artery, but the body was able to break up the blood clot on its own before much damage was done. So the person had the symptoms, but they didn't on the scans. We're not seeing anything anymore. Another possibility is there are several other conditions that can look like stroke with the symptoms and signs, but they're not actually related to blockage of an artery. The aura of migraine, so a percentage of people who get migraines will get some neurological symptoms with that, typically visual symptoms, but some people can get symptoms in the limbs or language symptoms. And then seizures or abnormal electrical activity in part of the brain can sometimes look like a stroke as well.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much for calling. And Edie in Shell Lake, on to you now. Hi, Edie.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my question. You might have touched a little bit on my question in the last answer. I've had three episodes of visual disruption in the last probably 8 years, lasting anywhere from 5 minutes to 20 minutes. And if I ask you, you know how frost forms on a window? It's kind of like a crystal.
Yep.
Okay. Well, and then if I take my field of vision as a big circle, mm-hmm. and I draw and I put a crosshair in it and divide it into quadrants, mm-hmm. I've had in the upper left-hand quadrant a swath of this crystal, like you might see on a window pane, mm-hmm. this crystal-like squares all over, and it doesn't hurt. It doesn't affect what I do, except it's in my way of vision. I kind of see around it and through it and beyond it. I don't have any other physical symptom. And my general practitioner never could make much out of it. Of course, I didn't ever go in when I was having this episode. But the ophthalmologist that I saw said maybe it could be a migraine symptom, although I do not ever get headaches unless somebody actually hits me on the head. I'm not prone to headaches at all.
Yeah, yeah. The vast majority of people with migraines just have a headache. A smaller percentage have neurological symptoms with their headache. And a very rare person can have these neurological symptoms, which we call the aura of migraine, without headache. What you're describing could be that. You know, there's a lot more involved, and of course I'd recommend if you do get that again to go into the emergency room to get checked out. But oftentimes people do have this, and they end up needing to see a few different specialists, like a neurologist and an ophthalmologist, and get some tests. But often the tests are normal in the case of aura of migraine. And really what spells it out for us is that over time a person starts to get a track record. They kind of keep having these same symptoms happening, but there's never any injury to the brain on the scans, and the examinations are normal. And sometimes we just need a little time to figure that out.
Mm. Okay. And then may I just ask one more question, please? If we're talking about people that have stroke that don't have any risk factors, what should just the average person do? Just wait until something happens? I mean, how do you know if you have atherosclerosis?
It's a good question. Basically, everybody gets it eventually, and the question is whether it's ever going to cause you a problem, a blood clot in an artery. And, you know, my general advice would be to see your primary care doctor from time to time, and they'll check things like your blood pressure and your cholesterol. You know, avoid tobacco, avoid excessive use of alcohol, eat a healthy diet, and get plenty of exercise. So kind of clean living in general is the right thing to do.
All right. Thanks, Edie, for calling. Appreciate it. I did want to mention, before we take another call, that you've got a run walk coming up in Fitchburg, Slow Pokes Against Strokes.
Yeah, thank you very much for letting us do a shameless plug. We're you know, trying to start a community of people to help with help with fundraising for stroke research here at the university. And at McKee Farms Park in Fitchburg on Saturday, June 13th at 9 a.m., we're going to do a run walk. And so there's a 5K run and then walks of a quarter mile, half mile, three-quarter miles, and a mile. And we're looking to get people involved, both regular people from the community and stroke survivors, as well as people that care about them.
And so to find out, so what do people do? Just show up, or do they?
You can just show up. We have a website. It's folksagainststrokes.org, and that would be, they have all the information on there about the event, and if a person wants to get involved or volunteer in any ways, we certainly could use all the help we can get.
All right. Folksagainststrokes.org, is it?
That's it.
All right. Tim in West Salem, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Tim.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I was just curious. I wanted to call in and question my stepson. It's my understanding, my wife would know a whole lot more about this than myself, but it's my understanding when he was born, he suffered from a stroke. At least that's what the doctors think. Mm-hmm. And he has a condition now. It's called preeclampsia. And I was curious if the doctor had ever heard of that or is knows anything about preeclampsia. And what it is basically is... he's 6 years old, extremely intelligent. Mm-hmm. He can't talk. Mm. He has a speaking device called the Tango that he uses, and he also does sign language. Mm. Now, the one problem that's really frustrating for us is that I have really good health insurance, and his father, it's my understanding, has really good health insurance too. Mm-hmm. But the insurance companies will not pay for the intensive speech therapy that they say that he needs. Mm-hmm. And if the guest had any suggestions on how someone could go about trying to get intensive speech therapy in the situation that, you know, he really needs it.
Yeah, that's a great question. We do see it's, you know, much more rarely strokes that can occur either in utero when a child is developing or early in life. And I think aphasia is the term for disordered language where either problems with producing language, spoken or written, or understanding language, either spoken or written. And, the main people to work with are speech-language pathologists, speech therapists. And, as far as how to actually arrange that and get that covered, you know, the best person to talk to would be a social worker, and your primary care provider could put you in touch with a social worker to try to help get some coverage for that. That can be a very difficult condition, especially when it happens early in life.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. So as we think about this, I do want to review the things that people should – what are the signs first? The sudden weakness?
Mm-hmm. So sudden numbness or weakness of the face, arm, or leg, especially on one side of the body. Sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding. Sudden trouble seeing in one or both eyes. Sudden trouble walking, dizziness, loss of balance or coordination, and sudden headache with no known cause. See any of those things, we'd recommend calling 911.
And the things that a person should ask a possible stroke victim would include?
And ask the person to smile and see if one side of the face droops. Ask the person to raise both arms and see if one arm either doesn't get up or drifts down. Ask the person to repeat a simple sentence and see if the words are slurred or gibberish or if they don't understand you. And then the last part is to call 911, because we do have some effective treatments, but we have a very short period of time to make that happen.
Yeah. And also to mention the Run Walk, Folks Against Strokes, it's June 13th, right?
Saturday, June 13th at 9 a.m. at McKee Farms Park. And come on out.
And it's go to folksagainststrokes.org, and you'll find out some more about it.
Exactly.
All right. Dr. Jensen, thank you so much. I hope you'll agree to come back and be with us again.
I'd be happy to. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Matt Jensen is a neurologist and an assistant professor in the School of Medicine and Public Health at the UW-Madison Clinical Sciences Center. And a lot of good information here, and I'm hoping that... Well, I don't hope anybody has a stroke who's listening, but I hope that you made note of the signs. I hope you made note of the questions to ask people. I ask them to smile, speak a sentence, simple sentence, raise both their arms. Those are the some of the things that you can do to determine if a friend or relative is having a stroke. And if you're doing it, it's maybe a numbness in the face, arms, or legs, difficulty speaking or understanding, walking, difficulties or lack of balance, and then that sudden severe unexplained headaches. That's another thing to be on the lookout for as well. So we'll have Dr. Jensen back, and we will do this once again. Coming up, we're going to take a look at preventing and treating dental disease. Dr. Lowell Lackritz, our guest next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.